Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We encourage you to check out our guests' website because we link to them. We'll be giving you our guests' website for this program here shortly, and we encourage you to see what resonates with you, see what works for you, and so forth. We have a rather interesting program today because we're going to delve into a little bit of, I say it's history. A history because I remember going through it. I remember the experiences back in the 80s, the transition that was impending in the 70s that happened in the 80s, supposedly. And yet at the same time, our guest sort of makes the conclusion of sorts, and we'll talk more about this with him. The New Age began sometime in that decade, and we're now looking back. But this particular work that we're talking about is sort of his, in a manner of speaking, his life story. He talks about drowning in the light, memories of the New Age. And my guest is Jared Rosen. And Jared, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. It's great to have you on.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
It's very interesting because I remember, and I've talked with people about this, and they go, really, you remember the harmonic convergence? Well, I remember that it was supposed to happen, and it was this transition period and all of these different things. And, so from that standpoint, yeah, I remember it. I personally don't recall anything of a minor or major occurrence within my own personal experience that happened. But at the same time, I can look back, and of course, hindsight being 2020, and I've never had 20/20 vision, mind you, Jared. It's very easy to see that, yeah, there were some pretty monumental things that were taking place on this planet and with the people. And even to this day, there are still more and more changes happening that are actually exciting a lot of folks. They're beginning to learn and understand that nothing is written in stone, in spite of what our politicians and our religious leaders and our educational systems tell us and so forth, that anything can be changed. Case in point, the most recent piece of history is this whole business with what they call the Brexit vote. And, I'm listening to people saying, okay, so they voted. So what? You know, and who says it's a bad thing? I don't know either way myself. But they're saying, there's so many things that have to happen, so many dominoes that have to fall in the right way for this whole scenario to unfold. Who knows? I've always felt the same way when any time Congress, when they do work and they pass a law, I say, look, it's not written in concrete because they can change it. They can modify it down the road. And they've started to do these kinds of things. So in our own personal lives, and I'm sure that you've experienced this as well, Jared, nothing is written in stone. And yet we tend to live our lives as though I'm stuck in this pattern and there's no way for me to get out. But you went through some from my perspective, because I haven't experienced the level of challenges, I'm going to put it that way, as opposed to turmoil, challenges that would have stopped a lot of people, but it didn't stop you.
No, it hasn't stopped me yet. I just feel that we have a great blessing to be alive and to have the ability to experience so many different experiences in this lifetime. And I think that people are trying to, it's interesting, Brexit, it's like, exit, like to try to get out of something. And for most people, they're trying to get out of the fear of death. And it haunts, as soon as we're born, it haunts us. Don't climb up there, you'll fall and kill yourself, my journey, I feel like with this journey that I intentionally created experiences so that I could have a context, and I put myself in situations, and I'd say for most people, we all do, we all have, the quote-unquote dark nights of the soul. Mm. But I intentionally tried to find out where are those dark nights, I even worked, you know, with the criminally insane. I wanted to get underneath, you know, underneath the hood and see, well, what is it with the human condition where we could choose such beautiful opportunities of creating peace and harmony, and yet we foster such, you know, such pain and suffering.
Well, you you went where most men don't want to go, your own psyche, your own inner self. A great poem that I quote quite often, or at least paraphrase, from the author, I believe the name Tiberius was his last name, basically talks about the gods, and they're conversing about their concerns over man and how, you know, man is, you know, becoming much more enlightened. And we, you know, they're almost scared that man is going to elevate himself to their level. So they need to hide the secret. And they talk about hiding it in all kinds of different places, but theorizing that, no, he'll find it there. He'll find it there. He'll find it there. In the depths of the ocean, and the heights of the mountains, in outer space, blah, blah, blah. Finally, one says, I know where we'll hide it. We'll hide it in his heart. He'll never look there. We're starting to look there.
Yes, there is much hidden in the heart. Because the heart, when we talk about the heart, I mean, we can talk about the human heart. There's so many different connotations to the heart.
Yeah.
When we talk about the heart of something, it would be the center and really the source. And, you know, the heart of the matter, you know, the source of the matter. And interesting, when I went into, you know, my investigations, I went pretty deeply into science. You know, first I had these epiphanies through experiences. And then I tried to figure out, well, what is it? And how does it all work? What, you know, how do we get here? What is this going on? And in those investigations, I delved into quantum physics enough to see that matter seems to be, you know, a precipitation out of this infinite eternal realm that has, you know, that's not operating within time and space, but all possibility exists. And so that to me is the heart of the matter, the heart, you know, and that's where I was going for, like, well, you know, who am I? And that search, you have to, you know, dive into who you're not, which, you know, can take you through some interesting, you know, maneuvers.
Was there ever a time as you began this process, and one of the periods of time, you actually studied, and am I correct? You are a shaman. You studied down in Peru.
Well, you know, it's a word I would never use on a resume, and I did go through an initiation. It was an interesting time, though. I had come out, and, you know, and my book really kind of chronicles it, but not as my memoir or my memories as much as a context or a story that will give somebody an experience that will hopefully create some openings and transformation. But essentially, it starts out with this sort of, like, you know, the artist that didn't fit in, that, you know, I was that round peg and it was only, you know, a square hole. And so art was my path, and I open up where I'm in New York City in the art world in the late 70s, and it's a pretty exciting time, and how I just kind of blew out. I was studying yoga, and all of a sudden on my own, and I just had this massive, like, transformation. And so as far as shamans, I actually started studying all these different interesting things. Before I know it, I was invited on a trip by Alberto Villoldo in 1984. With a, you know, a small group, you know, of a half a dozen of us, and went and studied with Don Eduardo Calderon. And it was, you know, an initiation experience. But why I actually bring it into the book, and it comes really right out of this chapter in New York where I'm, you know, with Andy Warhol and the models and the rock stars in that world, to, you know, finding myself standing in a fire, marching with a sword and drinking a mixture of taboo perfume, San Pedro cactus, and black tobacco juice through my nostril. I'm like, okay, so what am I doing this for? What is the purpose behind this? And so these are the things, you know. So, but, you know, with great due respect to Don Eduardo and Alberto, it was life-changing, you know, to pull myself out of the world that I was in, which was, you know, all manicured and, you know, wrapped in cellophane, you know.
Tell me about your perspective on, as you put it, the new age. I mean, I was working for a Christian radio station during the height of what was called that the harmonic convergence, and the new age movement was just really sort of taking off. And I found that quite fascinating and intriguing, to say the very least, and began my metaphysical or metaphysician's search at the age of 17 with, as I've told many people, my metaphysical primer of Autobiography of a Yogi. And so as I'm working with this radio station, I'm thinking, you know, boy, you people, you really need to open your eyes a little bit, because as much as you would hate to acknowledge this, your religion, the Christian religion, it's a Middle Eastern religion. That's where it was founded. And yet you turn your back on that part of the world in terms of your origins. You know, Christianity is not an American religion. Although it's been made into.
Oh, really? I thought it was invented in Mississippi. No.
but by the same token, you know, I have to respect people's perspectives on things. But at the same time, it's like, wait a minute. If the truth will set you free, then let's do some freeing here, and discuss what really is the truth here. And first of all, when you talk about metaphysics, Christianity is a metaphysical religion. Because the definition of the word itself, according to Webster's, is beyond the physical. And that's what Jesus spoke about. Most everything that he spoke about was beyond the physical. It was not a literal material interpretation in that respect. It was, look, you're going to communicate with God. And so on and so forth. So I'm curious as to your observations and perspectives on, as you define it, the New Age movement, if that's the right word, or just
sure.
The New Age.
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you're mentioning religion and, you know, fundamentally, you know, all religion is metaphysical, because it's all basically saying that something that cannot be seen in the human dimension is responsible for the human dimension. You know, this is not my life. This is the life of God. These are not my acts. These are the acts of God. And that's that surrender and that beautiful place where people go when they go on the spiritual journey, whether it's, you know, Christian or Buddhist or wherever it is. But I think for me what the New Age represents, and why I brought this into this book in the first place, was, interesting enough, the title of my book, Drowning in the Light, actually was a title that came to me to actually create a performance back in 1987 in Santa Fe, New Mexico, shortly around the time that the Harmonic Convergence was being sort of virally spread. But that time, the viral spread was by word, but mm-hmm. It was by newsletters and newspapers and, you know, and things of that nature, since there was no internet. And so, you know, there was this fervor of change and transformation, because we were getting close to the millennium. And of course, you know, the Mayan calendar had some significance that was brought to people's attention. But the comical realm, and see, my book, and I wrote this book because the deep, dark comedy of it all and the amazing transformation equally needed to come out in the same book. My research into quantum biology and transformation and higher consciousness, and my observation of you know, coming out to California, you know, after my Peruvian experience and starting a new life and coming out to Marin County and, you know, meeting people and like, well, what's your name? Angel Waterfall. Oh, yeah, and this is my husband, my partner, you know, and his name is, you know, is, you know, Bodhi Lighthouse or something, you know, and I was like, okay, so this is like a you know, as I came from New York City and the new wave art and you know, sort of neo pop movement that I was involved in to some degree, you know, seeing this sort of culture that, you know, was always about, you know, healing. And I was very interested in healing and interested in the subject, and because I had opened the door had opened for me already, you know, quite a while ago. But just to, you know, to see people that everyone was doing some form of healing for a living, yet a lot of trading was going on, because that's what they were paying their money on, was other healers. So healers were healing healers. And yet there was this feeling like, you know, that we were actually going to end up on the other side of, you know, of this transformation, you know, heaven on earth. And, you know, you can say it is, and it has been, and it always is. So it's very hard to delineate when change is happening, but I think, you know, why I felt it was interesting in the context of this book is I found myself later on working with authors on books around 2012 and the Mayan, you know, some of the bigger books and more important subjects, you know, around that. And yet the last chapter of my book is actually titled, you know, December 21st, 2012, The End of the New Age.
Now, it's interesting that you put it in that context. I have to share that my wife had a great little take on the whole thing with people going berserk over the end of the Mayan calendar and thinking it was the end of the world. And I loved her take on this, very humorous. She said, you know, the guy that was working on it, he got to a point in the Mayan calendar, he says, that's it, I've had enough. And he just kind of threw up the hammer and chisel and said, I'm done. And walked away, and that's why it ended. But I looked at it as Y2K. Nothing happened in Y2K. People flipped out and went berserk. And I remember it was a Friday, the 31st of December of that year, of 1999, and I always filled up my car on a Friday because I could get, you know, a week's worth or 2 weeks worth of gas out of my car. And there I was paying for my gas, and this woman comes flying in, and she's just out of her mind. I've got to hurry and fill up my tank because, you know, the computers are going to go down and da-da-da-da-da. I said, and I was working for a news talk station at the time, and we were listening to the news coming from places like Australia and where the time change began, and they were saying nothing was happening. It was, you know, the computers weren't shutting down and the world wasn't coming to an end. And I says, you need to calm yourself, because I told her that I worked for a station and we'd been getting the reports from the first places that transitioned to the 21st century, as some people said it was the year 2000. And I said, you just need to calm down. Well, I looked at the Mayan calendar in December 21st of 2012. In exactly the same way. And the real irony was I was having knee surgery on that very day.
Oh, wow.
And it was
metaphor
fabulous.
There, huh?
Yeah, what's that?
You had to have a metaphor there, right?
Exactly right. And hey, you know what? It went perfectly, and I was walking good around that day. So
on the other side of the change. But I do want to say that there's relevance to the, you know, from my perspective, it's like this. It's like we're moving through a celestial realm. We're on a journey. It's like we're in a car, and we're on a car trip. And I think of New Mexico because I lived in Santa Fe in the 80s. And I remember you're driving in the desert, and all you see is those little teeny pinions. And you think, well, that's just the way it is. That's New Mexico. But if you get to the higher elevations, all of a sudden there's ponderosa pines. Before you know it, you get up to the top elevations. There's this lush aspen forest, you know, with tall green grass and wildflowers, and, you know, and looks like it's out of a, you know, Sierra Club, you know, calendar. And like, how did we get here? And so I think this is an evolution, and I think we don't really see it, that the Earth is moving, you know, through a celestial, and there are alignments, and I think many of the ancients knew of these things and know of these things. But the thing is, everything is changing always, and everything is always ending. The world is ending for somebody right now, you know, and that's it's always the end of the world for somebody, you know.
Well, true.
So,
well,
you know,
I mean, that great REM song, you know, it's the end of the world as we know it. Well, I can't go back to the 60s that I loved so much as a kid growing up. They're gone. That world is dead. It's over.
Well, you couldn't get an internet connection if you went back.
And I have to tell you,
it'd be like, "What, man? I can't get any Wi-Fi." They'd be like, "Hi-Fi? Oh, you should go over to the great new stereo store. They have Hi-Fi."
And I tell you what, having no Wi-Fi sometimes is that's perfect. I would love it if there were no internet, because sometimes it can just become so overly intrusive. But again, I think that's one of the things that, you know, as I was sharing at the beginning of the program, you know, nothing's written in concrete. Everything is in flux. It's in change. As you say, we're traveling down this road. I've even heard of this concept of these nine waves, that we're going through the ninth wave that's traveling through the universe. And that ninth wave is giving us the effects of the other eight as well, in terms of raising the consciousness of the people and so forth. And it's, you know how they, you know, people talk about, you know, the 99% and the 1% from an economic standpoint. Well, there's the 99% and the 1% when you're talking about spiritual or metaphysical aspects. And quite honestly, it is the 1% who aren't quite ready to embrace this concept. But it's the general populations around the world who are basically saying, you know what, we've had enough. We don't want to play this game anymore. Right. We have to play, it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, we have to play a game because that's what we do here.
It is what we do here. And I think that's the, you know, the beauty of it when we can recognize that, that it is like a, you know, each individual goes through their own soul maneuvers, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And those are circumstances that show up in life. And those circumstances give us an opportunity to grow. Many times we repeat the same things over and over again, and it's like you don't hear the whisper, and then all of a sudden it's just screaming, it's too late. You know, you should have been listening to the whisper.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that as a species, we haven't really been listening to the whisper, and I think now we have the scream. And I think, you know, the scream is pretty loud. I mean, if you look at, you know, just what's going on with terrorism, the fear of terrorism, I mean, isn't this blowback for, you know, what we've done in the Middle East for the last 40, 50 years and the oil industries and militarization and all these kinds of things? And it's like we don't see the cause and the effect. But where I really come to is the place of being the observer and understanding that, you know, we are evolving on our own timeline, and the human species is evolving on its own timeline. And it's like if you look at a scale, you look, let's say, at a keyboard, you have the high end of the keyboard and the low end of the keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
I think people that are over-identified with the physical and feel so much separation, they're in a denser place. They're hanging out at the low end of the keyboard, but they're also handling the details of the grid of life, you know, as we all are.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people hanging out on the high end of the keyboard, and that's those high notes are very spirit. It's more spiritualized than matter. It's more spirit than matter. And I think that's where I kind of got lost in my self-discovery, and many people, perhaps in the New Age, have gotten lost in that discovery and the addiction to self-discovery when they know that true self-discovery is you find no thing, you know, and that is enlightenment, and it's not glorious and glamorous, and you know you don't put it under your name on the, you know, on the book title. You're not, you know, special because you have this awareness. You're actually waking up to, you know, to the illusion. And I think the thing that really troubles people is the feeling of separation. Every negative emotion we call negative emotions is this feeling of separation.
Yeah.
And I think religion actually has, most religions have created that feeling of separation because they're saying, well, God is up here or over here or down here or over here, not there, over there, you know, and it's anything outside of the self, going back to what you originally said about the heart, the hiding in the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And you know, it's interesting. You talked about that whisper. And of course, we've talked a lot about intuition, the still small voice. And I'm going to give you an interesting case in point. I have many, many examples of this in my own life, but the most recent one was, as of the day of our conversation, I happened to be out at the beach, as the marine layer was still rather thick overhead, and it was very nice and cool. It was like 61 degrees and a nice breeze coming off the water, and the surf was rolling in at low tide. And I was walking along and just, you know, kind of musing about some of the things that have been going on, and I decided I better turn back, better head into work. And as I'm walking along, I come across this rock, and it's about the size, big enough that you can hold in your hand, in one hand, and comfortably. It's not real heavy, and it had all these wonderful striations on it, these stripes, if you will, like layers of sediment and so forth. And it was just sitting there in the sand, and I looked at it, and it kind of stood out to me, but I kept right on walking. And the further away I got from it, the more I was drawn to go back and pick it up. And I kept walking away from it, and it got stronger and stronger. I kid you not, I actually said out loud, no one else was around me, okay, I'll go back. I'll go back. And I turned around. I went back, and I'm thinking, oh, great. And somebody's probably already picked it up, and they've probably thrown it out into the ocean or something, and it was still there. So I picked it up, and I brushed a lot of the sand off of it, and I carried it back to my car. And I gave it to my wife, and that was the prompting. What that means, I have no idea, other than the intuition, the still small voice, whatever you, that, to me, that's the same description as the whisper. There's a reason why I was prompted to do that, whether it was the rock is significant and will be to my wife, or I'm delaying your departure from the beach because I want you to avoid an incident that is down the road along your path. I mean, now those are just two theories of mine.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm telling you, when I discovered a few things, one thing I discovered was that the time and space does play games, and we have such a fixed experience with it, we don't see when it's playing games, except in quote-unquote emergencies. And in my book, actually, I talk about what I call the zero-point experience. And those are those points that, A, could be like so much intuition that everything just sort of stops, and you don't know what the next, where the next segment begins. You're kind of in that void. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it happens to people. And I feel like that's a very, very powerful time. And many times that's when we make a decision. And that, exactly, it's a split decision, you know, split-second decision that, you know, and we're following a mind that is not just a thinking mind. You know, it's a feeling, sensing mind, and it senses where, you know, exactly, you may have missed an accident by going back to the beach. And I've been thinking of a story I had where I left my glasses on the beach, and they were very expensive, like, you know, $500-$600 glasses, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And eyeglass, sunglass, you know, the whole thing. And I started judging myself, and I was like, I just went through this crazy judgment, and I went back to the beach, and the sun was setting. And I said, let it just show up to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to, and I just walked, and I was like, just show up. And it didn't show up. This is kind of like what happens in my book, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I let go of it. I said, you know what? But at first I had to feel all this judgment on myself. You always lose your glasses. These are really expensive glasses, you know. And all that voice. And then when I walked back, I saw there was a little bench. And that was a bench where I sat on to tie my shoe when I realized I left my glasses. And, of course, my glasses were sitting right there on the bench. But I had to get to that place of equanimity. And to get there, I had to feel all this shit, all this, like, judgment on myself. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. We're on terrestrial radio.
That's all right.
I mean, I had to feel this in that moment, and all this self-judgment, it runs into our head. And, you know, and then you get quiet, and it's like, oh, there are the glasses. And also not even to be attached. And I think, and that's what happened to me, you know, with my health condition that I write about in Drowning in the Light, where, you know, I was this quote-unquote light worker that was completely illuminated and eating green food and all that, and, you know, of course, how would I ever get sick? You make it up. It's diseases, you know, a consciousness, right?
Yeah.
And out of the blue, after a very terrible divorce in 2008, I, you know, was quite traumatic emotionally. All of a sudden, I found bruises all over my body, and I was like, well, what's going on here? Which led me on, you know, on this journey to discover that I had a rare blood condition. And but the thing about it is, I went through this process. First, it was judging myself that I had created it. I mean, it's going back to the whole concept of the New Age and why, you know, one of the reasons why I think I wrote this book and why it's important to me to share this is I don't have a specific message. I'm not saying, you know, but I know for myself, I had such a strong belief that I was creating my own reality, that I created this, that I should be able to discreate it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, of course, you know, I created this. But to, you know, and that brought me to the same place, you know, like I was saying, and on the beach, well, all of a sudden, you know, I went through all this judgment, and it was like, well, the simple solution was right there. And of course, you know, after many, many years of fighting it, that solution was, you know, drugs and surgery.
Yeah. It's, to me, fascinating. And again, we don't always know why we do what we do. All we know is that we need to do it. I have often used the analogy of a fictional character from a science fiction series to describe our spiritual connectedness to each other and to that higher consciousness, voice, power, if you want to use the word God. And it's a strange character that you're probably familiar with, Jared, that I use as an analogy in terms of describing in I think pretty clear terms how each of us has a different task, but somehow all of these tasks seem to work together for towards the big picture, which we either can't or never will really be able to see, but we still have to continue to move forward. And that character just so happens to be the Borg from Star Trek Next Generation.
Oh.
And when you think about it, no two individuals are alike. They're not clones. And no two individuals carry out the same task, but they're all working, again, towards a collective, if you will, goal. But we're doing the same thing. We just don't realize it. And when we're listening to that whisper, as you, I love that term, the whisper. If we listen to that whisper, and then, and again, it's not enough to listen. I joke with people saying, look, if you're going to listen and not follow, then stop listening. What's the point? You know?
Right.
You know? And I remember
having a conflict with my inner voice.
Having a fight, even an argument. What do you mean I have to do that? No, wait a minute.
It's a cartoon character, you know, where you have on one shoulder the angel and the demon.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what happens is the demon cancels out the angel all the time, because what the demon does is it instills fear.
Mm-hmm.
And when fear lives in our body, it's pretty hard for us to have that angelic moment where love cancels out the fear. And that's how you see, I mean, even that's why I think in these collective, in these horrors, these tragedies, these mass shootings and things, you see such outpouring of love, intensity, like you can feel it, it's palpable. You go to like that site where the disco was in Orlando, you know, and anyone, I'm telling you, you know, somebody that hates gay people and calls them fags, go stand there on that sidewalk and look at all those flowers and all those outpouring of all those lives and all those beauty that people, you know, mothers, fathers, daughters, brothers, sons, you know, and we wake up. But, and I think that's what takes each individual, is to see that we participate in what we call the outer world and the creation of it and what it is.
Yeah.
It's not a prison. That's the illusion that, you know, that somebody's in control. You know, and that I think that's, you know, my particular journey that I reflect on in Drowning in the Light, it's all internal. I mean, I wasn't in any concentration camps or, I mean, what I suffered, I mean, I created that. I went and I, you know, with one chapter where I go off to some ranch, you know, to work with these kids, the most severely emotionally challenged kids you've ever seen in your life, and the place run by, you know, psychiatrist, in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, and I'm sleeping in the cabins, and, you know, it's the things that are going on. And I think that all this stuff was, you know, I needed to kind of, because my childhood was, you know, very white, suburban, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We had three color TVs.
Mm.
Yeah.
I can kind of relate to that. I mean, you know, I'd say that we were middle class growing up in the middle of Phoenix in a very urban area, and lots of play. I mean, I go back to that neighborhood every so often, primarily on Google Earth, and remember what it was like as a kid. There were no fences along the way. There were yards after yard after yard after yard. We played kickball down the street and across the street, and there were no obstacles. And it was a T-section at both ends of the street that I lived on. So if a car was coming, you saw it coming around the corner before you had to get out of the way. So, you know, we were in no danger, and it was great fun. But I'm kind of with you in that regard. And I think, too, yes, hindsight being 2020, we can look back and we can look at the progression. I do the same kind of thing. And I haven't been through the kinds of traumas personally that even you have been through, although I've been through a divorce, but I haven't been through major illness and those types of things. But I've had my second wife, who is I'm currently with. She's been through both cancer and a severe abdominal blockage, and she survived. She continues on, and I mean, her story is in that respect quite compelling by comparison to mine. But it's like we just don't know. I mean, you even talked about how you don't really have a message per se, but people who read the book Drowning in the Light, Memories of the New Age, they're going to find a message.
Oh, they'll find many. I can't believe how many people I have spoken to that they couldn't put it down. I mean, that's why, you know, I really didn't think I would write a book, especially a quote-unquote memoir. I mean, I've written books and I've been in publishing. I've published over 30 books, and mostly, you know, everything I'm involved in is about, you know, subjects other mm-hmm. than myself.
Yeah.
And somehow this has been a context for bringing a lot of knowledge and wisdom, I guess. But also, I think, you know, when my agent read it, he said, we have to publish it. And he said, there's a lot of people need to read this book. And I think that there is a sense, and we're going back to the kind of New Age beliefs, that we create our own reality instead of we participate in it. And for instance, you know, your experience with your wife, I mean, I think of mine and what she went through, and I feel like it was harder for her than it was for me, even when I had, you know, when they would give me a, bone marrow biopsy and sticking a needle into my bone, and I was like, at that point, you know, if anyone was there, I would have just killed them. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I you know, it brought up that you know, the monster in me because of the level of pain, but I think about what she had to endure, and it's not even endure, it's like, we share it. We share all the suffering, and if we don't allow ourselves to feel it, then, you know, then compassion is pretty far away.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, that's what your wife needed, and that's what my wife needed. And I'm lying there in the hospital, and I'm like, okay, is this it? You know, I mean, at the end of the book, my issue is that, you know, antibodies are killing platelets. And at the end of the book, I'm going over to, you know, Whole Foods to get a kombucha because my belly was hurting. But actually what was happening was gastrointestinal bleeding because I was bleeding from within because I had no platelets.
Mm.
And so my wife was like, you know, I guess we'll just have to, like, just pick you up off the parking lot floor dead from Whole Foods. And, of course, I was rushed to the hospital, and my platelet count was zero. But the comedy in it was, you know, it was like, oh, well, I'll go get a kombucha. like, and my thought is there are other people out there that are doing that,
yeah,
that are doing green juice fasting, and I'm meeting them, and they're showing up, and some of them actually have transformed and said, wow, the green juicing, I went from being, you know, at stage 3 cancer, but several, you know, are like, well, okay, I guess I basically need to start focusing on transition.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing too is that I've known people who have been doing the whole taking really good care of themselves for years and decades and decades and decades, and they still get hit with stuff. And
because we're in human bodies, Yogananda. I mean, his body apparently didn't decompose
right.
very fast. It, you know, he must have had a lot of spirit in that body.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, all of us, you know, it's part of the experience.
Yeah, indeed. We're talking with Jared Rosen. He's the author of Drowning in the Light, Memories of the New Age. We're going to continue talking with him as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. I'm here with Jared Rosen, the author of Drowning in the Light, Memories of the New Age, and a whole bunch of other works that we aren't going to get an opportunity to really go into at this particular point. But I will say this about the work that you're doing, Jared. I think that one of the interesting aspects for me anyway, It comes up from James Redfield and his Celestine Prophecy, if you recall that from the the 90s. And the specifically talking about the word that you used in regards to the book, this particular book, Drowning in the Light, messages. And that we, each and every one of us, we have messages for the other. And that it is incumbent upon us to share those messages, because if we do, then we can, then we are helping others to, and I put it in this context, we're helping others to put more of the puzzle pieces together for their big picture, if you will, and conversely, they do the same for us. And unfortunately, in the context of having to use another Star Trek metaphor, if our shields are up, we cannot get those messages to other people. Nothing can get out and nothing can get in. Yes, we can certainly fire our weapons, but that's not what we want to do. That's not how we foster, you know, community and connection and relationship, and foster that energy, if you will, of the new age, of the higher self, of the spiritual world, if you will, to foster a better world here. And hopefully, maybe, I don't know what the world is like in the hereafter. I really don't. I'm very curious. But I find that a lot of folks, they're getting to the point. There are a lot of folks, and I know them, I've talked with them, who they feel like they're not making a difference. And the work that they're doing is so profound. And that's my observation. Maybe that's a judgment on my part. But I see them making such a difference, and yet they don't see it. And I try to explain it. But again, they don't see it. Your thoughts on that aspect?
Well, I think that it's, you know, you mentioned earlier about religions and the jigsaw puzzle, and I'll take both of those metaphors and mix them up. It's like, I think that the truth has been like a beautiful urn that's been broken into pieces and different fragments, and we can pick up one fragment and say, oh, it's this way, you know, Buddha or Christian or... And I think we do it in ourselves, we feel very fragmented. And even the way the workplace works, you know, and we're working for a large corporation, perhaps, for people, they do feel like a cog in a wheel, because they may not know what the whole organism is. And I think the more we learn the whole, the more we have holistic systems and structures that recognize that everything is connected and see our connectivity and then feel like we're part of it. And that's a great company works like that. I've done a lot of work in consulting and looking at organizational structure, and I think that's the key to, you know, a great organization is you know, everyone knows the whole and they know their part really, really well. But if you just know your part really well and you don't know the whole, don't know why you're even doing it. Or why, you know, I think that's what we, you know, that's why we feel like we just, you know, we're born, you know, we eat, we crap, we, you know, die, and that's it, you know, and we work, of course, during most of the time, and for meaningful work and purpose is very important. And actually the work that I've been involved in, really, with my company Dream Sculpt Media, has always been about, you know, helping support artists, authors, creative people, to really find their distinction and to bring that out. And we have such a beautiful opportunity with the media world that we live in, to be able to create and share that, to actually be producers, not just, you know, be the consumers of media, but to be the producers of it ourselves. So I think people are waking up to that, and they're leaving the world of the corporate world and doing their own thing and creating their own platform and, you know, making an ebook so that they can, you know, get their thoughts out there and, you know, those kinds of things.
It is, I think, extremely important for every individual to get their message out, to get their story out, if you will. It's part of what this program's about, is to give people that forum, if you will, that that exposure, and we've had some notables and some not so notables. But that's, again, that's sort of a judgment on my part as to, you know, people who, and I find this phrase really kind of humorous from my perspective, because I don't fully understand how in the world somebody who has never written a book before can have, quote unquote, a bestseller on Amazon. And then the next person I interview has a bestseller, you know, number one best. I mean, wait a minute. Not everybody can have number one. There's got to be 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Well, it depends what the genre is. So, that's true. It's almost comical. I mean, because I've been in publishing for many years, but I've been working with the disruption in publishing to create new forms, new media, hybrid ebooks and things. And that's what we do at Dream Sculpt. But we've worked with lots of best-selling authors and worked with a lot of people that haven't had a chance to be a best-selling author. And what's the same thing is not to focus on being the bestseller, not to focus on that, but to focus on really sharing what, you know, because that's why people write books, to sharing the beauty, the literary, you know, beauty of the work, and distribute it in a way that people will get it. And that's, you know, why I've been doing what I've been doing with Dream Sculpt is we've worked with, you know, some of the most brilliant authors, people like Dr. Irvin Laszlo, father of systems theory, but taking his work and putting it into, you know, what we do in mini ebooks with video clips with Marianne Williamson or Deepak Chopra makes it more digestible. But everyone has a story, and I really love people coming to me with just an idea. It could be, you know, a concept that they wrote, you know, on the back of a napkin at Starbucks 3 a.m. And we help them develop it into a book. In many cases, what it is the brand. Because like I said earlier, for a lot of individuals, they want to kind of leave the rat race. And they realize at this point in history with technology, they can create their own thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's that sense of purpose that you were talking about, that you feel like, oh, I'm really I'm doing my thing.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, going back to the 60s, isn't that what it was all about?
Doing your own thing. And, of course, also another thing that was about the 60s, and I was a kid. I wasn't even 10 years old when we hit the 70s, and it was about going out to find yourself. And, of course, here in the 80s, 90s, and in this 21st century, what I found is you don't have to go anywhere if you will just,
right.
just stop. Just stop. You know, I'm telling you, stop. you're right where you need to be to find yourself.
Right. Well, that's my book. Really, is it's funny that you say that. That is the full circle of drowning in the light. And I use the metaphor, and I don't want to say a metaphor, but the actual Zen cone. That is, those of you from the 60s may remember, it was a great Donovan song. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain.
No mountain. Yes, I remember the song.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I won't try to sing that one. But the first there is a mountain is like, well, this is just reality. It's just the way it is. You know, this is just the way it is. This is it, right? Isn't it? Okay, wait, hold it a second. Then there is no mountain. Well, really, what is reality anyway? And then, of course, you come back to, okay, well, it is all an illusion, a holographic projection. But you know what? While I'm here, you know, I'm going to have fun, and I'm going to make people's lives better, and that's the purpose, perhaps, of a life, you know?
Yeah.
Spread the everything that every positive thing that comes through you in this lifetime, you know, to be able to share that. And that's why I loved writing this book, and it was important because it had to come out of me. And my agent said, you know, you got to write this book. But I love helping other people and support their books. And actually, if they come to Dream Sculpt, actually to the website, they can even submit their ideas and what they're working on or their ideas. And that's a way to connect with me, because what I see sometimes is it's like the diamond in the rough. And, you know, and it is crazy world that they were publishing where, you know, you go online, there's, you know, you can be a millionaire, you know, make an ebook or be a best-selling author. And it's just, you know, it's there's a lot of, you know, questionable things going on out there.
Well, yeah, I would tend to agree with you. And you know, we all are feeling the, how shall I say it? We're feeling the frustration over feeling helpless, feeling powerless, when in fact we are quite powerful if we would just own it.
Infinitely powerful.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah.
I mean, that we go back to the earlier thing when I was like, Trayson, where is matter coming from? Where am I coming from if I'm made of this stuff? And that stuff is coming from some kind of vacuum state where all potential exists, which is, it sounds a lot like, I mean, if there is any definition of God for me, it would be that source, that field, that fundamental reality. And we're always there. We just have to be quiet, and that's that still place. When we recognize we're there, then we can observe and we can see what I did in my book, The Comedy of the Outer World, because it is pretty funny, especially the New Age.
And I know, too, that as I was growing up in the New Age, and again, growing up, I was in my 20s and on my search, and it was rather humorous from my perspective anyway that I would share the fact that I would never say that I was a metaphysician or that I was studying all these other things with all of these Christians. I would say that I'm on my search. And I was told by one a pastor at the station once, once you find Jesus, your search is over. And I knew well enough, and I put it very kindly to him. I said, well, actually, from my perspective, once I find Jesus, my search has just begun.
You know?
And
you're looking for everyone else.
Exactly. And I've been searching ever since. Now, some would say, well, yeah, but didn't the search ever come to an end? It's like, no, not until you die. Maybe then your search ends. But I guess the best example I can give, I don't know about you, but for me, I had an opportunity to go back to Phoenix back in the early part of June of this year to celebrate my parents' 60th wedding anniversary. And my baby sister, Mary, she basically gave a very eloquent off-the-cuff speech. As far as I know, it was off-the-cuff. She may have rehearsed it. I don't know. She did really well, all I can tell you. And she talked about the legacy. If you want to know about the legacy that Mom and Dad left behind, just look around the room. And we're talking about 35, 40, 45, maybe 50 people there. Now, certainly there could have been more, but, you know, they didn't want to go completely nuts and, you know, invite half the population. But, you know, and I even had the privilege of interviewing my parents in August of 2015.
Wonderful.
And it's been made available to my family, and I promised them I would not put it on the radio. But maybe after their passing, I might go ahead and do that. But we talked about that in the context of the interview. And they, of course, they say, you know, we never thought of it or looked at it that way. This is just what we chose to do.
What a treasure to be able to interview your parents.
Oh, yeah. It reminds me, I don't know if you're familiar with what's called StoryCorps. I heard about this on NPR. And my wife and I on Fridays, we love as we're coming down to work to listen to these little recordings of people who are sharing. Maybe they're sort of being interviewed by a relative, a brother, a sister, a mother, a father, that kind of thing, about particular events that have happened in their lives that have been transformative. And I thought, you know, that'd be a great place to put this. So, you know, I'm thinking about that as well. But the whole aspect of legacy and the question of the continuation, not just of the species, but the continuation of a particular bloodline or family name, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, or I don't know, maybe fortunately, my father's bloodline ends with me as far as my branch on the tree. That's it, because I've chosen not to have children, more for medical reasons than anything else. But I have sisters who have had biological children. As a matter of fact, at the family reunion, we had four generations in the house. My parents are great grandparents. I'm a great uncle, and I got to meet my great niece for the very first time at this gathering. She's, I think, like three or four years old, and she's just full of spunk. My mother says that she's got my energy as when I was a kid. I'm, oh boy, you're in trouble.
Could interview her.
Exactly. And
that's a lot to say.
Let's talk about that a little bit before we wrap up the program. In terms of, here you have this book, because as a matter of fact, I'm going to pause that question and I'm going to ask this one first. In regards to the title, Drowning in the Light, how does one, in this context of our conversation, how does one drown in the light? And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, that's you know, that's actually, you know, a title is abstract. So you can call it whatever you want, but since the subtitle is Memories of the New Age, that defines what the abstract title is, and that's my memories of, you know, and that I share in the book, you know, participating in this, you know, it starts out, you know, in my childhood, but, you know, it just starts out in New York when all of a sudden, you know, this energy is unleashed, and I see that we're, you know, in an evolutionary process, and I just keep jumping, you know, further and deeper into the exploration. So it's like diving into the ocean of unconsciousness and in some sense drowning, because, you know, whether it was my initiation in Peru where, you know, it was a sense of being, of dying there, and or when I actually, you know, came inches away from it myself this past year when I was brought into the hospital and had a zero platelet count. So I think that the drowning also is, it's the drowning in the light also is, it's the sort of dark comedy tone that I want to set, because that makes it a fun read. And, you know, and the fervor of wanting to transform and grow and evolve and see the planet evolve and turn into light, you know, that passion is, you know, is in that drowning type of, you know, metaphor. It's just like drowning in knowledge. Like you would go to the, you know, UCSF library and take on books on quantum biology and biological superconductivity to figure out if do we really need to eat, or can we actually, you know, can we digest light directly, universal light? I mean, that's how far out I went.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think people enjoy the read and all the experiences that I had. And once again, the full circle is coming back to, you know, where I am now, which is, you know, of that Zen cone. It's, you know, first there is a mountain, then there is a mountain, then there is.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is, you know, there is life.
Yeah. It reminds me of a piece from an old sitcom called Barney Miller. And one of the very more esoteric individuals was talking about these individuals who don't eat. They just breathe, and they call them breatharians. And they just inhale, and that's how they keep going. And then one guy was sort of hyperventilating in the cell, and he says, hey, leave some for the rest of us.
Oh, God.
I just love that.
Yeah, well, I came to the place that, yeah, that we actually could metabolize light. Well, you know, so the cows eat the grass, it eats the photosynthesizes the light.
Yeah.
So I would say basically, you know, if that was my mind frame, then I wanted to go out to lunch with somebody, I'd say, yeah, let's go out and let's have a light bite. Let's have a light lunch. Let's have a light lunch.
But haven't
you? I didn't even have to prepare it. It's already there.
It's already
but,
there.
You know, and then there's the other side, which is you just want to sink your teeth into that yummy, delicious ethnic cuisine that
yeah.
is off the truck, food truck.
Do you ever notice, too, we have cats, and we have the doorways, the front and the back doors to our home face east and west. And the other morning, as the sun was rising and sun was coming into the house through that door, our cats would lay in the sunlight. I mean, it was like they were sunbathing. So I have to wonder, you know, if there is indeed some truth to that. I mean, the animals wouldn't be doing that if it wasn't
enjoyable.
Well,
we get vitamin D from the sun. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You really do.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, do you want to drink milk or do you want to go lie out in the sun? You know, I mean,
or
you can do both, but it's still producing the same thing.
Yeah.
But I think what I really love about the drowning part is because in drowning, you do have to surrender if you're fully drowned.
True.
There's nothing left to do. But surrender, and there you are in the ocean. And you talked about the nine waves and all these things and that are going on. And I always hear about these things, you know, the 10 dimensions. And I mean, you know,
yeah.
There's a lot of intelligence with 11 dimensions of super string theory and all these kinds of things. But really stripping it down and all the numbers and everything like that, there really is one. It's one dream. It's one continuum, you know. And in each moment of it, it's like a click. Another click on the wheel, and you know, the wheel is turning, it's clicking, and each click we're in a different place, but it just keeps evolving.
Well,
here we are.
Exactly. I do have to say that it can be great fun at times. It can also be very frustrating, and we can get stuck and all of those things that happen in our lives. But I found that the more often we are able to be the observer, and we're still participating, we're not, you know, we're not sitting on the sidelines here.
Yes.
But as we are participating, if we can be the observer, there is so much more that we are able to, shall we say, absorb. And by the way, the only other word I could think of to replace the word drowning, and again, it wouldn't have the same impact as you have absolutely described. And I love that analogy of total surrender. If you're drowning, you don't come back. You drown. Was submerge. But that still doesn't have the same impact. You don't want to just submerge. You want to drown.
Anytime you submerge, you want to get the hell back up.
Exactly.
But when you're drowning, you just don't come back up.
That's right.
You know, unless they find your body. Well, this is getting morbid, but drowning as in the light.
Yes.
Think of it this way. Mm-hmm. Just breathe in and breathe it all in, because that liquid light is flowing through you. Your cells are made of cytoplasm, which is liquid crystal. We are light. We are liquid.
Mm-hmm.
We are that. We are all these things of the new age. It is true. But we just have to relax now and just relax into the world in which we are participating with, and understanding that our actions really do make a difference. You know, I feel good when I get in my car and, you know, it's electric and I don't have to, you know, think about what's coming out the tailpipe. I mean, and we can make those choices, and we can make choices in relationships. And if we don't hear the whisper, you know, then it'll be like, my God, every time I'm in a relationship, I always end up being abused.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe it. I have such bad luck. You know?
Yeah.
You haven't been listening.
This
is bad luck,
this
right?
This is true, yes.
Yeah.
Very interesting. By the way, a little side note as far as that's concerned. You know, I remember learning in the early years of my experiences with the New Age movement that we were moving from the Piscean era, the sign of the fish, into the Aquarian era. Obviously, you know, the song, you know, the Age of Aquarius. Well, that's all fine, well, and good. But what perplexes me is the fact that in the 12 signs of the zodiac, Aquarius comes before Pisces. And
that's an easy fix. We actually, when they talk about the precession of the equinoxes, we're going in the different directions. So we've been in the Piscean age,
right?
And we're coming into the Aquarian age. And with the Piscean age, what it would represent is, like, you know, it wasn't 1969. No, this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. You know, it happened then. Okay, that the movie here came out. That was Aquarius. This is all of us have been living in the cusp, according to astrology, between those two ages.
Yeah.
And the Piscean age, of course, the sign is that of the fish. So talk about drowning. You know, we are in this electromagnetic sea, which is really, it's an electromagnetic sea. I mean, you can't see all the space between you and I, but there's a hell of a lot going on.
Yeah.
All of the electromagnetic waves that are producing.
And that's very exciting to think about, too. That's very exciting to think about because of all of the things that we can bring about. And that we, if we will just own that power and realize, you know, that you are where you are right now because of all of the choices that you've made in the past. So what if you made different choices today? Imagine where you might be tomorrow. As a matter of fact,
that are not fearful, fear-based choices. That is the really key.
Yes, yes. As a matter of fact, forget about making any choices today. Imagine where you would like to be tomorrow and allow those choices to come. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I think that's, we have to trust that.
And yeah.
I think there's a combination. I think this is also sort of what I've learned in the New Age, because there were so many people that were waiting for the ship to come in, but they weren't actually launching it. They just were like visualizing it and visualizing the abundance and visualizing the abundance, you know.
Yeah.
$10 million was coming to me. It's coming through right now. I'm surrounded with gold. Well, get on your ass and do something.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's both. Because if you're just pushing to make it happen, it's not. So it's like one part grace, one part rigor.
Yeah.
The rigor is excitement and passion. And when you put that rigor of the excitement and passion to what you're doing, you forget it's 3 in the morning and you're supposed to go to sleep because you're so into it.
Yeah.
You know, that's with the grace. But when you need it and you make it happen, it's like the bestseller. It has to be a bestseller. I'm going to make it a bestseller. No, make it a best book. That's what I love doing when I work with people at Dream Sculpt, let's put all these preconceptions, all this out of the way and get into the essence of what it is. Because when you get into the essence of what it is, whether it's writing a book or whatever you love, you're now actually, you're not drowning. You're immersed in the essence of what you love. You're swimming.
You and I are going to talk further. I have been working on my book since 2001. It's not a big book. I suppose it could be if I added more to it. And so you and I are going to, we're going to have a continuation of this chat off air.
Absolutely.
Because I believe that maybe my time with this particular work has come, and I need to move forward with it. So you and I will definitely talk further. Jared Rosen, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program and sharing with us about yourself as well as Drowning in the Light. And if you are drowning in the light, then dive in wholeheartedly with no fear and just inhale until you can't inhale anymore. And enjoy the ride, to say the very least. But before we let you go, two things. Number one is, if you find yourself out here in the Santa Barbara area, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. And I know New York is a long way off, but...
Oh, no. I'm in Sonoma.
Oh, yes, that's right. Beg your pardon.
San Francisco. And
you
I
were
was
born.
In Santa Barbara last week. I come through it all the time. Lots of friends. Hi, everyone.
Well, then we'd love to have you in studio the next time you're here in Santa Barbara.
Absolutely.
That was New York I was
Make
thinking
it a
about.
Date.
Yeah. And the second thing is, we have three final questions for you before we wrap up the program. And the first one is, who is Jared Rosen?
Jared Rosen, also known as I.J. Rosen, author of the book, is a person who has been absolutely blessed in this lifetime. And everything that I share in my book and my story, I know is a piece of everyone's story. So I'm a piece of everyone.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, what I'm hoping for with what we do with Dream Sculpt Media and what we're doing with the Dream Sculpt Authors Incubator and everything else I'm doing is really to bring new forms of media that combine words and images and video and music as we're doing, and to do things that serve humanity and in ways that can be actually quite large, that there, things that we do can make huge impacts, and just if we're committed to them. So that's my life path, is being committed to those things that I know I can create at least inspiration out there.
And what is your life's purpose?
Well, that is the ultimate question I think we always ask ourselves, you know, what is my life's purpose? And I think the simplicity of it is, I came up with this a while ago, love is the highest standard. So that is my goal, is to raise every system and structure that I can to that standard, to look at education from that standard, to look at everything we do from that standard. Is it creating love? Isn't that higher than anything else?
Well, Jared, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program again, and look forward to chatting with you further and having you back again to talk about some of the other work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me on your show.
One area that I definitely want to get into next time we talk is the whole subject and discussion on art therapy. I find that fascinating.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. Again, my guest has been Jared Rosen. He's the author of many books, including the one we've talked about primarily today, Drowning in the Light, Memories of the New Age. It's available through Amazon, and also his website. I will give that information to you as well, dreamsculpt.com. That's dreamsculpt.com. We will be linked to that as well. Get more information there as well. And we again encourage you to check out the book. Until next time, I'm Richard Dugan, your host for Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.